You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. In today's podcast, for our worldview segment, we go to California and we cover a legislative act that is forcing churches to now cover abortion in their insurance plans. And for our main topic, we go through a real-life scenario chronicling the Kim family tragedy and the lessons learned from it. For our worldview segment today, we go to California, where a regulatory change just recently went into effect, August 22nd to be precise, and it has now placed abortion in the category of basic health services. Therefore, all insurance plans must cover abortions, to include churches. Now, of course, on the surface, this just seems ridiculous and ludicrous. And even when we watched the whole legal battle between Hobby Lobby and the federal government, I thought that was ridiculous to compel a business that is run on Christian principles, or any business for that matter at all, and force them to do something that they find morally reprehensible is wrong on so many levels. And this one just goes beyond that to include churches. So religious liberty protections are being thrown out the window. So the state of California is basically forcing all insurance plans to now cover abortions under the guise of basic health services. Now, this is at the insistence of the ACLU, and what they did is they concluded that there was a 40-year-old state law requiring health plans to cover basic health services. So now what they've done is just wrapped up abortion under that banner. And apparently all this time it's been misinterpreted, because obviously abortion has not been included under basic health services. And the news of this was slowly leaked. It was not put out there. It was done quietly, and it was given to the insurers who were grappling with this change and then informing their employees. And then, of course, it broke. The news, that is, that a California church would have to now include abortion in their insurance policies for their staffs and things like that. There's a quote here, and this article is from thefederalist.com, and it was published October 22nd, 2014. And it says this: "I want to formally share with you that on August 22nd, 2014, the Department of Managed Health Care notified Kaiser Permanente and other affected health plans in writing regarding group contracts that exclude voluntary termination of pregnancy. This letter made clear that the DMHC considered healthcare services related to the termination of pregnancies, whether or not a voluntary termination, a medically necessary basic healthcare service for which all healthcare service plans must provide coverage under the Knox-Keene Healthcare Service Plan Act." Now, all that is to say that this is now being wrapped up under that banner. And so now churches in California must provide abortion services for their staff. Now, this is being challenged in court. And so the Alliance Defending Freedom and Life Legal Defense Foundation, so they've filed administrative complaints with the HHS Office of Civil Rights. So we'll see how this ends up. We'll have to keep an eye on it and keep you up to date on what's going on with this. But the bottom line is this: it's time for Christians to stand up. We can no longer just stand on the sidelines. We must speak up, speak clearly, for we face this type of worldview on a daily basis, and it's time for us to actually not comply with this law. For our main topic today, I want to do something a little bit different. I want to explore a real scenario talk about that scenario, and then derive some lessons learned from that scenario. And unfortunately, this is a tragic scenario that we'll talk about, and it is with James. It's referring to James and Caddy Kim and their two daughters. Now, you may remember this. This happened in 2006. It was of this young family traveling through a winter storm. They got caught in it and ended up being stranded off a side road. And for James Kim, who finally left his family to try and get help, he perished, and the rest of the family were eventually found 9 days later. So what I want to do here is just cover the basic timeline, talk about it a little bit, and then derive some lessons learned. This happened the start of this happened November 17th, 2006. So James and Caddy and their two daughters, they left San Francisco, and they were heading to Seattle to spend Thanksgiving holidays with their relatives. Right, so they did that, and then on November 24th, on their return trip to San Francisco, they left Seattle for Portland, and their plan was to stay overnight there. On Saturday morning of the 25th, the Kims, they spent the morning in Portland with a friend and then shortly left for their next stop. They stopped at a tourist information center in Wilsonville. They got a map and some route information. 5 or 6 hours, they refueled near the town of Halsey, and about an hour south of that, they visited another tourist information center, and they were about, at this point, 230 miles from their destination. This was about 5:45 p.m. Now remember, this is November 25th, Southern Oregon. They called the resort from that small town of Halsey to say that they would be late and just basically to make sure that they didn't lose their room. The Kims then drove to Roseburg. That's now in Southern Oregon, where they stopped for dinner, and then they left for Gold Beach, which was going to be their destination. And they left there about 9:30 p.m. And they had about a 3-hour drive ahead of them. And their planned route was I-5 to Oregon Highway 42 and then U.S. Highway 101. So all very well-traveled freeways and roads. Now, authorities say that Mrs. Kim told them that they missed the Highway 42 turnoff. At that point, what they did is they consulted their map that they got at the visitor station, and they decided to use a route that took them along Bear Camp Road, which is a narrow, steep Forest Service road, and all the locals consider it hazardous, and it's also labeled as closed in winter on their map. Again, November 25th. So as the Kims proceeded up this trail or Forest Service road, they actually passed 4 signs warning that their route may be blocked by snowdrifts. About 14 miles up, so they were continuing down this road. And at this point, they're 27 miles, give or take, from I-5. They reached an intersection with another logging road. They stayed on the main route. I say main route as in the main Forest Service road. They went past the 4th warning sign of the night. You know, this is well past dark, getting late into the night. And it cautioned that the route may be blocked by snowdrifts 6 miles ahead. Shortly thereafter, a heavy snow started to fall, and then Mr. Kim decided to back his car down the narrow road until they got to that last intersection. So rather than turn around and head back to I-5, the Kims decided to take that offshoot, that left turn in the intersection, basically another logging road, which it appeared to go lower in elevation. So they took that road, and they traveled along that path for another 21 miles. They had to stop occasionally to remove large rocks from their path. By now, it's 2 a.m., and the Kims have realized, okay, they're disoriented, and so they stop for the night. Okay, remember, this is November 25th, so actually November 26th, early in the morning. So that on that Sunday, which is November 26th, rain was falling. They kind of got their senses about them, And they decided at that point, rather than kind of drive back to I-5, they made the decision to stay in place. Later, Mrs. Kim told authorities that they feared becoming stuck in the snow and figured, hey, you know, they'll be discovered real soon by forest rangers. They periodically ran their car to generate heat. And now we're into Monday the 27th. They awoke to heavy snow. They were using melted snow for drinking water and periodically ran their engine to generate heat. The next day, November 28th, pretty much the same thing. Snowed and rained all day. November 29th, Wednesday. Remember, this all started on Saturday, and now it's Wednesday. Weather started to clear. The Kims were kind of getting their senses about them. They started building fires with magazines and did their best with the wet wood that was around. And it was at this point that in San Francisco that the Kims' house sitter filed a missing persons report. Okay, so they on Saturday they took off. They were expected to be home that following Sunday. And it is now Wednesday, and their sitter finally filed a missing persons report. That following day, Thursday, November 30th, day number 5, the car ran out of gas. Kim's actually used their spare tire to start a fire in the afternoon, and the Portland, Oregon police began investigating the missing persons report. And that night, the first reports about the Kims appeared in the news media. The next day, December 1st, they had burned all 4 remaining tires. And remember, they had obviously run out of gas at this point. And they were trying to signal. They had heard a helicopter and obviously were not found at that point. December 2nd, Saturday, 1 week, about 7:45 a.m., James left the car in search of help out of an active desperation at this point. He built a fire for his wife and his 2 small children. I think they were ages of about 4 and under 1 year. He said he'd be back by that afternoon. Their thinking is that there was a small town that was about 4 miles away, and that was their perception from looking at the map, and it was actually 15 miles away. So James said he walked on the road for about 10 miles, and then he, for whatever reason, decided to get off of the road, and he ended up in Big Windy Creek Ravine. So he decided to get off the road and then take the creek. I'm assuming he was just taking it downstream to try and find something. The caddy heard helicopters throughout the day, but were not found. On Sunday, after walking about 16 miles and spending the night outdoors, James Kim died of hypothermia. The exact time of death is not known, but they really kind of, you know, assume that he died within 24 hours of stepping out. So sometime either late Saturday night or early Sunday, he died. He was found with tennis shoes on and light winter clothing. December 4th, Monday, so now 9 days, sorry, a helicopter searcher spotted Caddy Kim and her children, and they were taken to a hospital. They were obviously rescued and released in good health. The following day, on Tuesday, search and rescue personnel found clothes and other items identified as belonging to James. And the following day, they actually found his body, and he was actually in a shallow section of Big Windy Creek. And so after 9 days, the wife and 2 girls were rescued, and on the 11th day, they found James's body. And so that's the basic scenario. That's a real-life tragic incident that occurred. And And now I want to talk about some of the lessons learned. So obviously, they made a lot of mistakes. And let's be honest, if you do any kind of research on this tragedy itself, you will find all kinds of bungled messes and lessons learned from it, to include not just the Kim family, but with the officials that were involved, with the search and rescue personnel and those types of things. But in my opinion, the main blame obviously has to go to the Kims, as terrible as the situation is that they put themselves in that situation. And so, yes, there was bad decisions made with the search and rescue personnel and public officials. But, you know, those are very difficult situations. And in fact, having been a search and rescue pilot for 3 years, I can tell you, when you don't have a whole lot of information to go on, search and rescue is certainly an art and a science. But when you don't have a whole lot of information, it becomes a whole lot more art and a whole lot less science. So some lessons learned here. First of all, with the Kims themselves, well, where do you start? I mean, they just made a terrible decision after terrible decision. And again, I know we're doing the 2020 thing here with hindsight, but it's helpful to us, and so we don't allow ourselves to get in these types of situations. Probably a little bit overconfident. They did have some experience in that area, so it wasn't completely new to them. But first of all, taking these unknown routes was a terrible mistake, and they should have stuck to the main roads for sure. There was no reason. Once they missed their cutoff for Highway 42, they could have just turned around, went back, got on Highway 42, and made it to their destination. And what they really did is they had a case of get there-itis. And that's a common term that can be applied to just about anything. It's very common to find in the aviation community, where you hear about a lot of accidents with small planes or even military aircraft because they all had get there-itis. So for whatever the reason, they pushed the weather, they pushed their timeline, they pushed mechanical issues, whatever the case may be, because they had get there-itis. So it may be that the Kims had some of this get there-itis. But certainly getting off the main, off the beaten path, was a huge mistake. It's just not a reasonable course of action. Secondly, being overconfident in technology. Now, that may or may not have been involved in this case, but in a lot of times and cases, people just rely on their GPS or whatever the case may be, or even maps. And that's important to talk about. That's a good lesson learned here, as they had a map and the map showed, hey, we can take this route here. It'll be somewhat of a shortcut, and it looks like it's perfectly feasible. Well, maps, especially when you get off the main highways and roads, are not always accurate. That's just a fact, and you have to assume that this map is not accurate, especially when you start talking about topographical maps and those kinds of things. You always have to assume that it's, you know, a road that was there, it could be overgrown or blocked or slightly different than it's depicted. It might be seasonal when the map is showing it to be you know, a hard surface, that kind of thing. So you just have to be aware of that and be very careful when using maps. And you have to assume that they're not completely accurate. A third lesson learned here is the failure to heed the warning signs. Once they did make the decision to get off and go onto a Forest Service road, at any number of points, when their intuition was telling them, maybe this isn't a good idea, they should have turned around. And they passed not one, two, not three, but four signs that said, hey, snowdrifts may apply. It's like, this is a sheer sign that we are in the wrong place. Let's just go back. Let's eat our pride. Let's go back. And yes, it's going to take longer. And yes, we're going to get there even later than we thought. you know, but oh well. And so that was another terrible mistake. And even on all of this, they're traveling in the Pacific Northwest in November, at the end of November, and they don't have any emergency equipment in their vehicle. Okay, they didn't have any very much extra clothing. They didn't have any sleeping bags or extra blankets or any source of heat, maybe even just some candles. They didn't have chains. They didn't have flares. They didn't have jumper cables. You know, these basic emergency kits that everybody should carry in their cars, especially if you live in the Pacific Northwest or any cold climate environment. These are just basics that anyone should have. So they were not prepared, in addition to all those mistakes they made leading up to this. And so with that, with the get there itis, with the realities of the Northwest and the lack of preparation, they found themselves in a terrible, terrible position. You may or may not question their ability, their decision to stay in place. Now, normally, in almost every case, that's the best thing to do. But the reality is they knew how they got there. If they simply retraced their steps on the road and stayed on the road, they could have gotten out of there. Now, I understand that they were worried about trying to turn around and getting stuck and that kind of thing, but I think they could have found a way to backtrack the way they came in, and that probably would have saved them, especially if they would have made that decision a little earlier on. At some point, they were at a point of no return, and they were kind of just stuck. And then at a point of desperation, he decided to head out. And again, that's a tough call. You know, in most cases, the best thing to do is always to stay put. You know, but I mean, he was desperate. He was trying to do the right thing for his wife and kids. And so, you know, I can't really fault him for that. Although at that point, he was probably very much weakened, and probably the better decision would have been just stay in place. But again, this is all hindsight. There were some other lessons learned with regards to SAR management practices and things like that. But I don't want to hit on those things. I really want to just focus on what the Kims could have done better. And so, first and foremost, be prepared. Secondly, don't put yourself in those types of positions. Be careful with maps. And then here's a really big one. And I think, would have saved their life. Think about this. It was 4 days before anyone even thought that they were missing. 4 days. Winter weather, Pacific Northwest, traveling. They could have simply told somebody what their plan was. And that could have triggered, say, the house sitter to file a missing persons report after 24 hours, for example. And that would have started this search much sooner. And it could have been the difference between James taking off or not taking off. Maybe they would have been found on day 6 instead of day 9. And so have a plan. As silly as it seems, tell somebody your plan. In the military, we often use the acronym GOTWA. And you can morph this for civilian applications. And in this case, it would have worked out great. So very simply, you're telling somebody GOTWA. So where are you going? Others you're going to have with you. So very simply, it's the Kim family. The time you anticipate being there. Okay, so they could have said to their house sitter, hey, we're traveling. Our last stop's going to be at this hotel. We're going to be there at this time. So GOT, where am I going? Others I'm taking with me. And the time I anticipate being there. What to do, the W, what to do if I don't arrive or if I don't contact you at the certain time. So if I don't contact you within 12 hours of my anticipated arrival, I want you to call the hotel and find out if I arrived. Okay, so it's very simple, and can be morphed to that. You simply tell somebody what you're doing, where you're going. It doesn't matter if it's on a road trip or if you plan on going cross-country skiing. Both are important. And if you get into a habit of doing this, it could have saved James's life on this trip. So that really concludes this scenario that I have for you today, and I especially wanted to bring it to the forefront considering that winter is among us, and especially if you live in cold climate areas, get that emergency weather kit in your vehicle and be prepared. Our scripture for today comes from Exodus chapter 20, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 17. And God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.